Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. My guest today is Rabbi Avi Katz-Orlo, who is the Vice President of Program and Innovation at the Foundation for Jewish Camp. Before joining the Foundation for Jewish Camp in 2008, Avi was the campus rabbi and assistant director of the St. Louis Hillel at Washington University. He spent 17 years as a camper and then educator at a variety of camps. And I've asked him to join us on the program today, as camping is one of a very large area in Jewish life. And it seems to be not only strong, but growing. And the experiences that campers have in their camps have really shaped their Jewish identity for the rest of their lives. I'm interested in exploring the impact of Jewish camping a little more, especially for those who choose to become Jewish professionals as a result of these experiences. And the other reason I wanted to bring Avi on the program was to discuss making menches, a periodic table, which outlines 43 Jewish values into categories of wisdom, courage, honor, justice, moderation, and transcendence. When I first came across this tool, I thought it was really fantastic for people of all ages to really think about these values in their life. And I'm excited to hear more about it from Avi. So welcome to the program.
It's a thrill to be here.
So start, as we always do, with a little bit about yourself and your experiences that led you into this position.
Sure. The shortest version of my bio can be said, I was raised conservative, educated Orthodox, married Reform, and as a student of religion, probably think Reconstructionist. I grew up going to day school, going to shul, but camp is really where I found myself thriving. I always loved it there. I loved it because it was a real fascinating educational forum to do really interesting work, to get people out of their own way, to really do the heavy lift of transformation. Spent many years going to camp. And when I graduated college, I went on shlichut to the former Soviet Union. I was in Minsk for almost 2 years, running camps, day camp, overnight camp, youth group, the whole soup to nuts of youth programming in the country of Belarus. And I found it's just a powerful media. I thought when I went to rabbinical school that I would be a Hillel rabbi for the rest of my life. I was blessed to spend 4 years at Washington University, really enjoyed my time there, really enjoyed the pluralism of really painting a picture of what a utopia could look like on a college campus where all these different kind of voices, Jewish and non, could exist in the space of the university. And then a unique opportunity showed up where I could take that to a bigger scale within my love of camping to work at the Foundation on Education. Eventually that evolved to be the Director of Jewish Education. And about a year and a third ago, I transitioned to be the Vice President for Program Innovation there.
So what is the day in the life in your kind of position look like? What kind of work are you doing for the Foundation?
I oversee our program, all that we do in terms of anything from field expansion to leadership development to Jewish impact. The Foundation existed for about 18, 20 years, depending on where you count from. That time has been focused on residential camping, and we still have a lot to do there. We've made a lot of progress, still have a lot to do. And now we're opening up the chapter of what day camping will look like. Day camping is a unique opportunity to get to families earlier on in the food cycle with less barriers, both emotionally, psychologically, and monetarily, to make a Jewish choice. So we're trying to figure out how do we make the biggest impact on day camp. Foundation for Jewish Camp works at about 160 residential camps. That's growing with our third class of incubation. You know about the second one with SciTech. We're starting off or working with day camps probably in the order of 200, but easily could be many more day camps around North America, and try to figure out what are the highest priority of needs and highest priority of opportunities.
So what are some of the trends that you're seeing as you do this work over time and interact with these professionals in these camps?
A number of years ago, I was talking with Rami Aryan, who's the founding director of the Foundation for Jewish Camp. And when he got it going, you know, he went to camps and said, we should start this umbrella organization. And I looked at him as if he were crazy. Like, why do we need that? And I think we've passed that already. I think that they know why they need it. I think they enjoy the opportunity for professional development, the opportunity for raising the esteem and the work of the world of camping. And at its core, camp's about a bunk. And people want cohort programs because they want their bunk. They're people that they trust. When it hits the fan, people they know they can call. And I think methodologically, one of the most fascinating things the foundation did is put resources behind developing cohorts. And I see over time, incrementally, and those increments are cohorts that have been invested in, the field growing and deepening. And we know as a central agency, our best asset is when they don't call us with issues, they call each other. That means a field is born. So I feel like what is being searched for, especially within the world of camp, which is incredibly lonely work. These camp directors are my heroes. They stay up at night for 3 months worrying about everyone else's child. That's the campers and the staff members that they treat as their own children that are in their stead. They are responsible for them. And still they have to field questions in their community of, so what do you do the rest of your year? They're demeaned routinely and they're lonely because no one understands their lives. So the opportunity for them to be with other people who understand the challenges they face and the glory they have of what kind of success they can, of their impact is very special. So the time that they get to meet with each other and actually move forward and pick up those exemplary practices and also give them forward is opportunities of really building a field. When you get a chance to talk to these Vatikim, these people who've been at the field for 40 plus years, you know, they talk about the fact that the camp that they're running now, they would never be hired to do that 40 years ago. The industry has changed so significantly that they would not be hired to do the jobs that they're doing. And how much the field has changed, how much the work has changed, how much the competition has changed. But also, like, no one knows their glory, no one knows their pain, and no one knows their passion and their impact. It happens off in the woods, so...
Right, in a bubble.
They don't get recognized for it. Mm-hmm. But they themselves know of their glory. You know, they themselves know of their impact, even if other people don't yet.
So even just seeing the evolution of this cohort, this field of people to support each other in the camping world has really made an impact on these professionals, sounds like.
Yeah, and I like to think there's some depth of the content and the process and the professionalism that we've also helped them wrap their heads around. But I think that's a slight hubris. I think the reality is they really need company. Mm-hmm. People who are wiser than them if by mere dint of being further down the road that they can help guide them on the path and opportunities we have to connect them with each other in constructive formats, I think actually gives depth to the field and meaning to their work.
So for a field that most people don't understand, you know, what the 10 months out of the year looks like for those 2 months, what would you say to somebody who's thinking about this as a career going into camping full time?
It takes a certain kind of tipus, a certain kind of character to be a professional camp person. First, you have to have the stomach for sleep deprivation and for the sense of responsibility that people's lives are in your hands. That takes a very certain kind of character that can live with that. And that's why these are people my heroes. They're the ones who are making the space for transformation to happen. My wife and I are blessed with 4 children. That is a huge responsibility right there. Can I imagine 400 children? And they take responsibility for them. It is not simply a insurance liability. These are people they care about, they care for. These are people they know. I mean, and that's the thing about camp is, since there are no grades, it's dismissed as informal. And the reality is, since there are no grades, people actually show up and they present their whole selves and they are vulnerable and open to transformation. Once you set up that safe space, then all this other good things can come from there. So you have to set up a whole year of not only recruitment of your campers, recruitment of your staff, engagement of your families, all the systems in place, a huge seasonal staff that needs to be recruited and trained and moved up in the system. Every good camp director knows they're running 2 camps. They're running a camp for the kids and a camp for the staff members. When you compare not-for-profit camping to for-profit camping, it is diametrically opposed. How many for-profit camps don't take indigenous people to be on their staff? Where, and for not-for-profit camping, this is what we do. Of course, you become a camper, you become a CIT, and then you come back to be a counselor on staff. That's sort of the expectation. With all of the sense of entitlement and annoyance that comes with that, that's the game, which means our main production is not just experiences for kids. our main output of camp is we produce a whole cadre of young adults who create Jewish experiences for kids. That's our main export. Our main export is people who create experiences for other people. And the more that we are able to create those people, it's not surprising that a huge number of people who go into not-for-profit work are coming out of camp.
Right.
Not-for-profit work are people making experiences for other people. You know, so it's not so shocking that when you're 18 and you're given the keys to, you know, 15 souls of 15-year-olds, you know, and you're told to go and create experiences for them, and you're going to mess up. But it's okay, because we have the appropriate support systems in place for you to do the best you can, that these are the people who are going to go on to actually say, I have confidence. Someone had confidence in me. I don't know where it came from. But now I have confidence now, and I can take it till I make it, and I can make experiences happen.
That's fantastic. I love the idea that it's not just one camp for kids that you experience when you're a kid, but that there's a whole layer of experience for that staff of creating those experiences they had for those campers. That's great.
And then you have the division heads. You know, you have the campers, you have the counselors, you have the division heads who are creating experiences for counselors who are creating experiences for the kids. I have no evidence of this impact, but I would venture to say that's the goalpost for me. The more people we can mint in positions of supervision in camp, the more I'm confident of our professional and lay body, because those people know not just how to make experiences for kids, they know how to make people who make experiences for kids. That's another level of curating experiences, another level of intentionality. When you come back as an 18-year-old to be on staff, it is revealed to you who you were as a camper. Mm-hmm. When you come back to be a division head, it is revealed to you who you were as an 18-year-old. You know, it is that sort of amazing revelation of camp, since it's not being graded, but there is accountability. And there are all these wonderful support systems. You get to find out who you are, and you get to really reach for something you want to be.
What are some qualities that make for a really great camp? And what are some maybe pitfalls or assumptions that people trip up on when they're in these situations trying to create these experiences that end up kind of being detrimental to them?
I think the exemplary camps have radical mission alignment. You know, there's a camp that I was thinking of that comes to mind, you know, during staff week, they say, let's think about all the conversations we want to have this summer. Let's come up with a list of it. We're going to talk about all the things we aspirationally want to talk to our kids about. Now let's talk about some other things. They're not bad. They're just not on the list. So I'm not even going to go into the space of judging those other things, but they're not on the list. So how can we be laser focused in what we want to achieve? What works about the bubble is its internal capacity to cultivate its own sense of authenticity. In the larger communal world, it's often very challenging to preserve an internal sense of authenticity. Whether you're looking over your left shoulder or your right shoulder, you're always being called into question. Mm-hmm. In a context of a camp, which has a laser focus of mission alignment, it is profound how they can really go deep in a profound way of what their version of authentic Judaism is. Mm-hmm. And it need not align at all with what's happening in the outside world. But everyone's on board, because in this space, it works. In mm-hmm. this space, everyone knows what a good citizen is. In this space, everyone knows what you have to do to elevate, to achieve, to get that accolade. And it hardly matters what's going on in the outside world, but they can create that utopian vision and really deliver. And often it's the more countercultural it is, the more it works. This is absurd. And because it's absurd and everyone agrees it's absurd, it can actually be wildly successful here.
Because it's their absurd, right? It belongs to their identity.
Camp Havaya has an expression, this is how we be. In this space, this is our norms, mm-hmm. right? Outside, other people are telling us what the norms are, but here we're defining the norms and this is how we be. That has a profound effect, whether you're a 9-year-old coming into this world, or an 18-year-old recreating this world, or a 20-something inducting the 18-year-old to that process, mm-hmm. you know, of saying, this is how we be. Even if I know I have cognitive dissonance between how we be in this space, between how I am in the rest of my space, for 9 weeks I can be. Mm-hmm. I can actually be in this space. So I think camps that really have a profound understanding of how they are can actually get to the place of how we be.
The second part was, you know, for the struggling camps, for the ones that the mission alignment isn't really there, or they can't communicate it, or they can't create those internal bubble norms. What kind of stumbling blocks do struggling camps encounter?
This is two little gutters here. On one side, you have the gutter of maybe they're out of step with what the marketplace is wanting. And that might be from a vision perspective, ideology perspective, and or it might be facilities. You know, like, people don't stay in the camp because of facilities, but they may never get there to get to the camp because of the perception of facilities. It's not like I'm not going to stay in the camp because they don't have the nicest showers, but I might never get to go to the camp because the bathhouse is decrepit. So they're not marketable. The other side, I'd say, you can't be everything to everybody. A lot of camps want to say, we're everything. I think you often will judge a camp by their retention rate, not by their, you know, accrual of kids, but like how many they're able to retain. If you don't have a laser focus on who you are and what your product is and what the results are and what you're selling to parents and the experience that they're having of kids, you're not always going to have the best alignment to retention. So we don't always have retention as the mode that we often ask, are you likely to recommend? But if there's a lack of alignment there, I'm not sure I'm going to come back for it. But if I know what I'm going to get and it's what I want and you deliver on it, it'll be part of my life forever. And even if I cannot come back for whatever reason, I still want to recommend it as a good experience because they gave me what the bargain was. I think those are sort of two pitfalls there. And I think generally speaking, if like a Jim Collins flywheel, there are good camps that get better and better and their window of recruitment gets shorter and shorter because they're filling up faster and faster. And then there are other camps, you know, they're still putting kids in beds right before camp. And there's a point where it breaks in one direction or the other, you know, this sort of evolutionary process there. Because the camp that fills up quicker has more of their year to work on refining their program to making it better, to executing better. And
they're not focused on recruitment.
Right. And if you're focused on recruitment the whole time, you're never really getting ahead of making your program excellent. So you often need some sort of booster to get over that barrier, to start getting the revenue, to start hiring more senior staff to actually make that process easier of recruitment. The reality is it's a busier marketplace than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. More competition than there's ever been, which means we need to put more money into recruitment now, but which means we're taking money out of our refinement of our program into the recruitment. That's a challenge. You have to sort of continue to work with the marketplace and get with it.
And it also seems like you're also dealing with a lot of staff turnover. You know, not everybody has summers free. And for those who do, it's not necessarily, you know, every single year, infinitely, you're going to have this great head counselor or this great, you know, person to be able to stay with your camp from year to year.
So yeah, in 2008, 2009, when the bubble burst, you know, and the economy was bad, camps are doing fine because there weren't that much competition for the summer internship or the summer experiences for the staff. But now the economy is doing better. There's, well, I need to work on my resume. I need to do this. And we still have a lot of work to do. We and our partners in camping and American Camp Association, we all are in line of saying we need to do a better job of articulating the hard and soft skills you will learn by being a staff member at camp. We've allowed ourselves to be tribal in our perception. We do something off in the woods you wouldn't understand unless you were there. And we are unable to articulate to the staff member, let alone to the recruiter, let alone to the college counseling, you know, college career counselor. What are the skills you're going to get when you're a camp counselor that you would not be pushing paperclips at a law office for the summer? You know, what is your abilities of compromise, collaboration, creativity, group dynamics that you will learn in a profound way, honing your skills as a camp counselor, that you're not going to get making photocopies, you know, at the bottom of a hierarchy? It's all there. We just haven't done all of the work necessary to enable people to put a caveat on your resume.
Yeah, how to articulate those skills.
And they're all there. And the reality is with the shifting of what the marketplace of business is needing and the marketplace of education is trying to track with that, the need for those soft skills are going through the roof. The need for those ability to deal with a group. No one needs to know how to know stuff. You can Google anything. That used to be what education was about. It's gone. How to deal with people, right?
Right.
You know, that you're going to learn. I mean, there's no place like camp where you could have a place where the net is so high and there is no ceiling for how to deal with human dynamics and group dynamics. There's no place you can have a refined system of here's our goals, here are our accountables, and we're going to check in and we're going to check up and we're going to go through that process, a complete iterative process that's relatively short from a business perspective that actually is going to enable you to say, have I worked on these skills? And then if you come back, you're going to take to the next level and you're going to work on these skills. Look, I was trained as a rabbi and I cannot imagine how many of my rabbinic peers, they go through the rabbinic training being told you're going to be a spiritual leader. And in the end of the day, they're CEO of a small corporation.
Right, right.
It happens to be a synagogue. And in reality, very little of rabbinic education really dealt with the stuff that if they were a supervisor in camp, would have been their bread and butter. How do you run a meeting? How do you bring Torah to a meeting? How do you help that Torah actually drive the mission of your meeting? How do you deal with pastoral counseling event with a supervisee? You know, mm-hmm. How do you deal with that event with a supervisor? You know, right. How do you set goals? How do you hold people accountable? Those how do you give that feedback? That's so much more central to being that CEO of the small corporation than the simplicity of saying you're a spiritual leader. And I can't think of a place that's as robust that you'll be given as much support to fail at those things than a camp that has all that infrastructure there.
Mm-hmm.
Because even in the failure of that supervisor, the kids are still having a great time. Like even in that failure, the counselors are still pretty
good. They don't care, yeah.
I mean, they don't know you're failing. You know,
right.
You know you're failing. And you could really grow. You could say, oh, I wish I had done this. I wish I told this story. I wish I did that. I wish it, you know, whatever it is. And then like every other summer, you're like, oh, well, there's next summer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an iterative process.
Right. And it seems to be one of the challenges kind of in all stages, as you mentioned, very multi-generational camps is the new person, right? The new camper, the new staff person, the new year-round staff person who maybe didn't grow up at camp. How do camps deal with that? How do camps think about, you know, someone, you know, camper coming in or staff member coming in and everyone knows to go do this thing and has this norm and, you know, everyone comes back to camp into their camp mode and this person doesn't quite get it. Is that a challenge for a lot of camps or do those people end up maybe not fitting in or just jump right in? How do you see that challenge?
We see it all the time. Summer camps are much more intentional and better about it. Some are much worse. The most obvious example of this are, you know, most camps bring shlichim. I mean, they're specifically going out of their way to bring people who are not from camp. Their intention is to bring them because they're not from camp, because they actually have something else to bring to the game. And some camps are better, some are worse at this. I always laugh. I'm like, what would it take to the camp director just to take the old t-shirts from like three summers ago that are just sitting in a closet and give them to the shlichim or the new staff that are not from there?
Right.
Because within a week of them wearing their shirts, the kids will make up a story that they were there that summer.
Right. Right. Make them feel a part of it all. Yeah.
The whole thing is a contrived utopian projection. You know, what is memory in this space anyway? Oh, I was there. I know enough stories. I can be there. Right. I mean, the same way, like I have four kids and when I can't think of my life with my oldest when my baby wasn't there. Because memory is a fickle thing, right? I can't even imagine my family without the baby. But there was a huge amount of time without the baby there. But I can't imagine it anymore because she's so central and part of the family. What's different? Now, the reality is that newcomer has to sort of also grow and be sensitive to the fact that there is an existing culture they need to respect.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem with Shlichim is they say, oh, I'm here to bring David Ben-Gurion in my backpack. He's right here. Can you all shut up and listen to David Ben-Gurion?
Right.
And the answer is, David Ben-Gurion has a lot to say, but he has to understand the context of the camp first. You understand where you fit in. And whether it's a shaliach or a new person to camp, the more that they can really let camp wash over them and find out where they have expressed value, where they can uniquely add. Mm-hmm. Camp is a strange place because it's so dependent on tradition and so craving innovation at the same time. You know, so we always talk about camp as this 3-year life cycle. So the first year you bring something new to camp, heresy. They're going to drive you out.
Right.
It's crazy. Second year, it's not so bad. The third year, we've always done it that way. Torah, Moshe, Missy, and I, how can you ever change it? Michelle Freeman, who runs the incubator, talked about, you know, that first incubator class when they had a camp, you know, the second summer for the camps, they changed something. And the camper were there the summer before were like screaming, how could you change this? It's always been that way. It's always been that way. the camp didn't exist more than that, you know?
Like, right.
But this projection of memory that it's always been that way speaks to sort of nobility of nostalgia. You know, Peter Berger talks about the nature of a lowercase orthodoxy. The brilliance is it's the wealth of take-it-for-grantedness. You know, so we want communities to be welcoming, but we actually like the walls a bit. Because when you finally scale them, you're on the inside. I've often pondered whether there could be a metric for the first moment a group is a group. You know, they have that opening circle and they're sitting in a group.
Right.
How long it takes between that moment and a joke to be made that is self-referential that makes everyone in the group feel like an insider. That time is the measure of the strength of that group. If it can happen in a relatively short time, I guarantee there are a lot of camp people in the room.
Right.
That joke, which 5 years from now is an exclusionary act of you don't get the joke, in the moment is an inclusive act of we're building community right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm making a new joke. Even if I told an old joke, I'm going to say it in a way that you're now a part of the joke. You're on the inside now.
Right. And for such a safe space for everybody, right, that they're coming for this experience of being who they are and being able to express that in this way, to make that change, you know, you're not just changing the name of a program, right, or what's going on in this block. You're changing, you know, the norms of what happens in that space during that time when you talk about trying to make innovation. And that initial reaction to be like, this is blasphemy. I can't believe you're changing this. Like, that's not how we do it here. That's not who we are, right? That kind of initial pushback in this very safe space experience that people have at camp.
And I think that sense of outrage speaks to something which is very unique to a camp setting, which is its true child-centered nature. The fact that they truly feel ownership. You know, so think about these two contracts. You walk into a synagogue. One of the first things I end up seeing is the memorial lights, right? There is a tacit contract, which is when you walk into this space, if you belong here, when you die, you will be remembered. You matter here. You matter so much that the building will actually bear your name. This light will be lit in your memory, in perpetuity, right? That is a contract when you walk into a synagogue. When you walk into a camp, one of the first things I see, or walk into a cabin especially, you see a plaque, a bunk plaque, with names of the bunk in 1987, you know, of these group of boys that's had an inside joke amongst themselves, which was the foundation of this mural and all their nicknames. And it is a contract. The contract says in this space, you belong and you will be remembered for the lives you lived.
I grew up at a Camp El Anim, and there's a barn where they give out their evening snacks. And once you get to be a CIT where you're the one giving out the snacks, you get to sign your name on the refrigerator, on the wall, on the door. As just as you mentioned, you know, there's names that go back decades. And then when you go to visit you or your kids start going to that camp, you can say, oh, look, like there's mommy's name. There's her friend, or there's, you know, kind of these things that are out there.
And what's fascinating is there's 100% a space in our community that needs to celebrate people's lives they lead and their deaths, and I find it incredibly meaningful. And what does it mean to that kid who's coming to the camp to find her mother's name? Of not only does mommy matter, but I can matter as a 9-year-old. I also matter in this space. And in so many other places in our community, there are other barriers to entry to power and ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So when a kid says, I'm outraged you changed the program, I am amazed and I'm so overjoyed that they feel ownership of it. Like, this is actually theirs. This belongs to you.
They don't feel that at home, and they probably don't feel that at school. And, you know, there's not many other places they really feel that ownership.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be so happy if my kids started writing on their walls.
Right.
No, I'm also thinking about, like, when they're in school, there's a teacher who's saying, I am the professional, and I went to a special guild school, etc. And there's a barrier between you and me. And when I'm in synagogue, there's a physical lectern that the rabbi is standing behind where he or her says, I went off to rabbinical school and I got this professional thing and I am holy, you know, it's separate from you. And these kids show up and say, I was in bunk 11.
Right. That's your ownership. Yeah.
Yeah. And I belong here. And if I play by the rules, I can come back when I'm 18 and I can make these experiences for others. I can come back to be a supervisor, make these experiences for other people. I think that's something really special about sort of that sense of ownership. And that's also why we have 18-year-olds as the quote-unquote professionals there, because they're accessible. Because they were, a couple minutes ago, they were campers, you know, and they actually feel like they own the place.
You've been listening to It's Who You Know, the podcast. I'm your host, Michelle W. Malkin. This episode has been made possible through the partnership with the Jewish Theological Seminary. JTS offers a variety of professional graduate programs, including the Davidson School of Jewish Education's New Disabilities Inclusion Concentration, which is part of their MA in Jewish Education degree. To learn more about their programs, visit www.jtsa.edu/admissions. Before returning to my conversation with Avi, I'd like to take a moment to introduce you to the guests for our next episode. Jen Symbol serves as the Manager of Impact and Performance in the Assessment Department at UJA Federation of New York and has been spearheading the Jewish Evaluation Network, which brings together professionals to discuss the importance of evaluation in their work. Here is a clip from our upcoming conversation.
I think it's making better decisions. You know, the Jewish world is very fortunate and very blessed to have lots of resources and lots of financial means, and to take those and to be more productive in how we think about allocating those resources so that the next generation is excited to be Jewish or participate in Jewishness, whatever that means to them, us not defining it for them, but that they are able to create their own meaning, their own communities that they're excited to be a part of, and not just us telling them what they should be excited about.
Be sure to listen to the rest of my conversation with Jen in our next episode of It's Who You Know. But for now, back to Avi. So do you think parents understand all of these layers of experience and education and camaraderie? Do you think parents really get it? Or are they just saying, oh, this seems like a great camp and we're going to send you off for the summer and it sounds like a fun thing to do?
I mean, I think different cultural groups have different expectations. Newer immigrant populations in America don't have cultural assumptions of camping. The way we do it is pretty unique to North American experience. That's already a different thing. I mean, most of research has shown sort of people are choosing camp based on their kids' peer group. So I think at some level, there's an assumption of like, I want my kid to have friends. I like this group of friends. I want them to sort of solidify that friendship. That might be why they go. I'm not sure that's why they stay. We have a real challenge right now with helicopter or snow plowing parents. That's a real challenge. There are plenty of people who grew up in camp who are also helicopter parents. And in many ways, it's because they love camp so much, they want it to work for their kid. It's coming from the nicest place of, it better work for you.
Right.
I'm so much invested in this working for you
right. That
I need to clear the path for you. You know, we need to prepare the kid for the way, not the way for the kid. But we don't always allow that.
When you talk about just the experience of camp and the ownership that the kids feel and the rituals that make it this safe bubble and the safe space for them, I don't know if parents are connecting to that or if it just feels like something that kids just do in the summer. Or you just send them to camp and they come back happy and that's great.
I mean, I think camp is a series of Mr. Miyagi moments of things being revealed. So I'm not sure it's even necessarily our advantage that they know what they're getting. Or to put it another way, I think this whole project might be a bait and switch to make Jewish parents. You know, you can ask my kids, I don't know.
Right.
I definitely often reflect that my best moments of parenting are a product of my being a camp counselor. My best moments are those moments where I respect the space of a bunk to deal with their own problems and without me swooping in to deal with them. Where I create structure for the chaos. Instead of trying to deal with the chaos, I just give it its time and space for it to be dealt with. Which I have that confidence because when I was 18, someone gave me that space.
In my own experience, you know, I have family members and friends who, you know, went to Jewish summer camp and grew up there with 5 years, 6 years, and maybe don't do anything Jewish at all now in their sort of adult years. But because of those experiences, they consider themselves Jewish. They have a strong Jewish identity, and maybe they'll send their kids to Jewish summer camp. But it seems like a whole separate Jewish identity to all the other ways of being Jewish, right? It's so separate from a synagogue. It's so separate from, you know, being a Jewish professional. It seems like an experience that you know, when people have it, really carries with them the rest of their life.
I would agree with you, but I would challenge your premise of the question. I think the days of measuring Jewish affiliation by candle lighting or giving to federation or synagogue membership alone are over. All those are wonderful things to do, but I don't think that will be the defining features of the future of Jewish life. I think the work camp needs to do is figure out what does lifelong connection to the identities we create in these, you know, bubble utopias actually mean when you're not at camp anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how do we measure those things? I'm not throwing up our hands and saying just because we can't measure them yet, we can't measure them ever, or just because we can't articulate them yet, we don't have a responsibility to articulate them. I always think of it like one of the most extraordinary, subtle, non-subtle things of camp is who the camp director allows of the young alumni to come up for Shabbat. Meaning, we're not saying these things, but we're saying these things. People are on parade, the good citizens who are living the good life, what it means to be an alum of our camp. We allow them come back up to camp to reward them, but to really parade them in front of the campers and the staff members of, this is a good person.
Mm-hmm.
This person's living it up. I never say those words. Who do we let come back? We let the good people come back. We want this role model continuum to expand beyond the scope of camp, you know, but we need to do more work to expand that continuum way beyond the 2 months in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Actually say, you know what it means to be a 30-year-old, not yet coupled, good graduate of my camp. Maybe you go to synagogue, maybe you don't. Maybe you get a federation, maybe you don't. Maybe you light Shabbos candles, maybe you don't. But there's a whole slew of other things that we've offered you to do that's consonant with our identity. I always think about your camp. You know, the fact that a nice group of young alumni show up for Israeli dancing in LA, that seems like a robust Jewish activity. That actually means something. You know, it's not a, oh, we do dance. No, no, we do dance. Profoundly connected to the Alanim culture of Jewish ritual, Jewish ritual life that's integrated into the very ethos of the camp. The
right.
centerpiece of the camp is the dancing space. So is it so shocking that a 30-year-old single person and living in LA might check in with his or her community by dancing on a Tuesday night? That makes sense to me. It doesn't fit within an older version. Look, I'm an Orthodox rabbi. I still have my assumptions around what my Judaism looked like, but I don't think that's public policy. That's personal policy. But there's no doubt my own sense of my own orthodoxy, I think I have a certain expectations of what rigor looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Might not take the same content or form, but I have an aspiration that it has the same kind of depth, same kind of year-round, lifelong commitment. And I think when we get to see the joy of what a holistic utopia looks like in a 2-month experience in the summer, when you can see people living joyous Judaism, you see that essence of what it could be, which is, I think, that silver bullet we're looking for of what continuity might look like in the 21st century. I think we need still some more critical investment to let those early germinations fully blossom, but they're there.
Yeah.
In ways that we don't see them hardly anywhere else.
Well, that brings me as a good segue to touching upon this periodic table, making mentions. I actually have it printed out and on my wall in front of me at work, because I just love sort of reading it and thinking about it and reflecting about it. When you think about ways you can take your experience at camp into your real world, right, into the rest of your life, this seems like a fantastic tool that I've really sort of globbed onto as just kind of a way to remind me of these elements and if I'm living in this way. So I'd love to hear a little bit about where it came from, how you guys use it, how you promote it. It'll be on the website, on your blog, for those who want to take a look at it. Talk to me about this tool.
So the answers that came about is reading about positive psychology, Seligman's work, coupled with what Tiffany Schlein was doing in terms of popularizing it. I realized there was a really interesting opportunity to really touch into what is at the foundation of the work of camp. You know, every camp director I would ask, when you're in that moment of sales, what are you selling? And invariably it would go back to, well, we make menches. And if I would press them on this, some of the excellent camp directors, you know, I was talking about before with radical mission alignment could define what that means the next step. But for a vast majority of camps, they didn't have the next sentence. If I said, so what does a mensch look like in your environment? It was sort of like fall apart. I realized that Seligman presented a scientific taxonomy and Tiffany Schlein presented a media that could really hold it together of the periodic table. And then I wanted to add more Jewish content, so I left a little more in there. All of Seligman's categories are included, but I elaborated on it, and I played with some of the stuff a little bit more. We also have a new website that we're producing where the periodic table itself is a program guide. So you can hit any of the elements, and all these other resources are popping up.
Oh, great.
Not fully populated yet, but very excited that that's out there as well. We realized that people needed that taxonomy, a common language, so that they could own their own space in that. Like, I remember a number of camps were like, oh my God, we're all of these things. I'm like, if you're all of them, you're nothing. If you could choose 3 to 5, I'd start to believe you, because then I could actually ask you where that shows up in your program, where that shows up in your space, where that shows up in the way you train and orient your staff, and what kind of expectations you're creating of outcomes.
And that mission focus, right?
And it gave them the next level of mission alignment. This is what we do. I always think about that camp director sitting in the room selling camp and saying, you know, this is what we got. This is our great facilities, a great program, blah, blah, blah. And the parent says, that's great. You're the Jewish camp we're looking at. We're looking at some other camps as well. Tell me why to choose your camp. And invariably, you know, the camp director says something about Shabbat or something about Birkat HaMazon or something like, you know, and the parent is like literally pulling away from them, literally moving away from them in the room. And right. The camp director is like backpedaling and like, we're not too Jewish. And they're like benching the star player. Like, we're not this kind of camper. No, we're not that. No. And I've talked to a number of camp directors. I said, can you imagine the other way around? And he's like, what do you mean? Instead of like playing defensive, can you imagine being proactive? He's like, what do you mean? What happens if you brought this periodic table to a moment of sale with a parent? And you say, look, on our camp, we do 3 things. We do awe, you know, wonder. We take our kids out to nature. We do gratitude and chesed, right? And I can imagine a parent saying in this moment, you're going to teach my kid to say thank you, right? I'm going to write you the check right now. I don't care how you do it. I don't even sure I care about Judaism per se, but you're going to teach my kid to be a mensch, and you're telling me what it's going to be, and you're going to get my kid to be grateful. I'm going to write you the check right now. Please tell me, how do you do it?
Right.
And then the camp director says, well, we have this thing called Shabbat. We have this thing called Birkat HaMazon. Right. And now our star player comes out. And the answer is, I'm not sure the new parent wants to buy Birkat HaMazon or wants to buy a Shabbat. They do want to buy their kid being a mensch. And if it happens that we have the most extraordinary technology to achieve that, we don't have to hide it, but we do have to sell it. So we need to sell it in terms of they will buy, which is, we are on your team of making your kid a mensch. It happens to be the way we do it is our tradition, the way we do it in our camp. And in that context, it could be the most capital T or lowercase t traditional answer. It doesn't matter, right? The answer is we're meeting their needs. Parents are hiring us to do a job, and we're going to do that job. The job is not a purveyor of Jewish ritual. The job is to make a good citizen the world. And there's some residual Jewish going on, so they say, oh, I want the kid to be a mensch. So they're hiring us to make a mensch. Now we get to avail ourselves of all this wonderful technology we have of how to do that. But how do we shift the conversation around? In the article I wrote for the American Camp Association, I quoted Clayton Christensen in his book, you know, The Jobs to be Done. You know, what are they hiring us to do? That's the critical question. It's not what we have that we want to get out there in the marketplace. No, it's what does the market need and how do we meet those needs? I think the framework of a 21st century version of Musar was to say, what is the essential job they're asking us to do? And how do we sell some of the things that we do the most traditional ways? You know, our camp has been doing it this way forever, but how do we express it to the client so they understand we're being hired and we will do that job? And I'm confident we'll do that job better than anybody else. No one will make mensches like we make mensches. Why? Because we know where our products are. We know how to achieve it. We know all the inputs, all the outputs, all the outcomes. And if we can be that mission aligned, we will achieve it.
It sounds like good advice for any Jewish professional to be thinking about.
Actually, when I put that together, I was thinking more about less of a process for a bunk than a board, about what are the core midot of this organization? How does it affect how our board engages in conversation? How does it affect how we engage with our professional staff, engage with our clients? Like, I think that's a sort of carte blanche. And the reality is we cannot prioritize everything. We need to pick what our priorities are, mm-hmm. and then we need to execute against them. And we need to be held accountable by them.
Right. And even just thinking not, oh, well, we do this program and that program and this program, we do these things, right? It's that kind of focus on that. This is our goal, right? The goal of your organization is to do what? And then you get there by doing, you know, X, Y, or Z. But that's how you're going to get people to engage with your work, is with that kind of focus.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the next level. And we realized that demonstrated a huge need for the next level of programmatics. You know, people were looking for, okay, what do we do in the next space underneath that? How do we execute that? Which is where the new website is, in terms of, you know, what are some texts that animate that? What are some programs that animate that? What are some, you know, activities that we could do to bring that to life?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't know where you're going, you're never going to be lost, you know? So
right.
I think it was also put out there as a challenge to say to people, define who you are. Let that be your priority. Let those be your North Star, and let that guide you. And it's not that other things are bad. No one's going to be like, chesed is bad. No, it's just not the things you're focusing on in this space. Like, the nature of that kind of work is to focus on that. I got a lot of criticism when I put that out there. There was nothing overtly Jewish there.
In the table?
Yeah. I mean, where's Shabbat? Where is Israel? Where is, you know, those things? And my response is, actually, all of those things are platforms to explore, discover, and articulate your midot.
Right.
So your Israel and my Israel are very different. Why? Because we have different priorities. We actually have different priorities. And once we actually start the conversation around character, a lot of the most poignant disagreements in the Jewish community actually are less thorny. It's not that you're committed to Israel and I'm not. It's actually you prioritize unity of the Jewish people and I prioritize justice. And
well, you could light Shabbat candles every single week and then, you know, steal someone's money.
Right. I was actually saying, how do those things that are so fundamental to a vast majority of traditional Jewish living, how are those platforms for our midot? And how the fact that most of those moments are radical disagreements in the Jewish community, how do we understand them in light of the fact that we have divergent opinions around what midot are central to our people or our organization? So instead of arguing around Israel, we say, of course we should disagree around this because we have different sense of what our priorities are.
Right.
Of course we should have a different experience of Shabbat. We have different priorities. So instead of disagreeing around them, we say, well, I recognize we're supposed to have different midot and different sense of priority around these things. Now I understand these disagreements in that context. It doesn't mean we suddenly start agreeing, but suddenly it's understandable that we will have radical disagreement. And actually, we should have radical disagreement.
The value of that, yeah.
The diversity of the human experience, you know, Judaism needs to speak to all of that. And there can't be just one answer for that. It's not going to work. So I think there's many ways I think pushing forward character education not only helps focus the organization on that radical mission alignment, but also helps dealing with issues of distress and conflict. Because you can back up and say, what are you trying to articulate here? And how do I recognize what you're doing is good because it is a manifestation of your person or your organization? And our disagreement actually is the fact that we disagree around that fundamental nature of our priorities. And once we can iron that out, or at least discuss it, we can actually navigate those other often really disturbing touch points within the pluralistic community that usually get ugly, and actually find ways to celebrate those moments.
I'm going to bring it a little bit more to the personal and kind of ask you how you keep it all together. You know, you mentioned you have four kids. I'm assuming that you travel a lot over the summer for your position, you know, doing all these kind of different coaching type work. You know, how do you fit it all in?
I would say a couple of things. One is I love camp people because they take their work, but not themselves, very seriously. And I enjoy working really hard. Also, in that context of humility, can give a frame of reference to that. Rabbi Lawrence Sykes, you know, said once, echoing another Hasidic saying of the two pockets, you know, in camping, there's also two pockets. In one pocket, we know that this summer could change the person's life forever. and it'll all be transformed. In the other pocket, it's just camp. You know, it's just camp. So I think it's helpful to recognize the seriousness and the commitment and the earnestness of the work ahead of us. And the same moment to say, it's also all okay. When my older kids were younger, it was a little harder. Now that my older kids go to camp, it's a lot easier. Mm-hmm. I think they have a deeper understanding of the work I get to do and a deeper appreciation of why I do what I do. My wife also works for the Jewish community. So we both have long nights. We have appropriate support systems at home. But in the end of the day, we all want to be seen. We all want to be cherished by the people we cherish. And the fact that my kids are coming to understand the work that we do out of the house and how we are always there for them. And we want to make sure that, you know, the luxuries we have at home, we can share that love with other people and share that joy with other people. And it takes a lot of effort to make sure, you know, we're busting your butt to make sure everyone's having, more and more people are enjoying Joyous Judaism. You have to make sure we're always having Joyous Judaism at home too. I think I've seen many times, you know, Jewish professionals hang up their own Jewish growth and development. I find that's often a challenge. So I've always pulled out of work, you know, sort of passion projects that enable me to have my own personal creativity come out and my personal voice come out that I find to be sustaining, not only to my mental curiosity and stimulation, but also a sense of personal growth. And I feel really blessed to be in a field, whether that's camping or Jewish not-for-profit, that there is a space for my personal growth. I think I need to claim it. Personally, I can't do that work by myself. I often need a chavruta of some variety or others. Mm-hmm. And I'm always taking up a writing project or a creative project with, you know, someone so that I'm continuing my own personal growth. And now that my kids are getting older, do I enjoin them to the same kind of process? To do a fun Jewish game development thing with my kids at home, or a learning project with my kid. I often feel like I have a camp at home, you know. I do Rose and Thorn every Friday night with my kids.
Yeah.
You know, because we have a little camp at home and it has to be Shabbat at home too. I have no doubt part of my kids' experience of why camp is so special is because in some ways it does last all year. They don't have their friends there, but, you know, the other accoutrements are still going on. And I don't overlook the fact that, you know, my ability to be there for my wife and my wife's ability to be there for me and our mutual respect and understanding of the work we get to do for the community is invaluable to someone who understands and gets what it means to be a Jewish communal servant and to give. I don't take that for granted that my wife not only appreciates what I do, but also has a deep understanding of what I do and vice versa.
Special. Any other last thoughts or things that have come up that you don't feel like you had an opportunity to express that you wanted to share?
I've been thinking more and more how camp is not just a location or a stage of life or something to do with your kids in the summer. Camp is an educational philosophy. And that's an educational philosophy that projects a profound notion of ownership, a profound notion of authenticity, a profound notion of serious fun. I love my people I get to work with because we laugh all the time because we're all in a joyous business, which is not to say difficult things don't happen. They happen all the time. But because we are in the business of Joyous Judaism, you know, we get the joy of spending my summer in a car, in a plane, in a boat, in every which way to see kids in a non-reflective space of joy, non-apologetic space of being in their own skin in a world that's increasingly complicated, increasingly divisive, for people just to be unapologetic who they are in a positive way. It just brings joy to living and feels like a special gift. And I think the work of Musar and the work of character education was just sort of an expression of an educational philosophy that wanted to give that joy beyond camp, mm-hmm. Really saying that work need not live at camp alone. It's on my kids' walls. You know, they need to be a mensch, and we have to smile the whole time.
I know we didn't touch upon this too much, but this is also a world in which they don't have their cell phones and their TVs and their video games and their iPads, and what that allows them to do and connect to one another in that space.
It is profound. And it's profound in a world where I have many more Facebook friends than I actually have friends. I relate to people not by swiping left or right. You know, what does it mean to create real relationships? And what does it mean to actually be present with all of our pockmarks and all of our blemishes to actually be seen for who we are and make real human connections? I think now more than ever, being present and unfiltered through a screen, society needs that. Not Jewish society. Society needs that. You know, so the more that we can unplug to connect, the more we have an opportunity to change society. We could talk about all the conflicts that exist in the world, and you still have to resolve things with your bunk bed mate, you know, and you have to do that in a way, you have to do it before you go to bed at night. And so that has to happen today, and which means you actually have to have eye contact. You're going to need to hug it out, and you're going to need to get there. And it's not going to cause nuclear proliferation, you know, by sending a tweet here or there, you know. So that opportunity of actually saying, let's model these non-crises that will actually help you build up that capacity to actually build real relationships. You know, we don't always get it. Yes, you see eye to eye in a school environment, but it's an environment where we're being graded, often perceived against each other. You know, whether you want to or not, there's a competition there. Only 5% will be in the top 5%.
Right.
You know, which means the other 95% are not with you. But in a camp environment, you all can get an A.
Right.
You know, you all can get an A. And that's really special. That's a different educational philosophy, that everyone can get an A. Which doesn't mean camp's for everyone, and that's also fine. But there's no doubt that there's a space that people can rise beyond grades, beyond competition, beyond screens, to actually find out who they are and who they want to be. One last thing. My thoughts go out to Camp Newman. I know there's going to be some campaigns to raise money to rebuild their sites. So find it in the notes where to give.
Yeah, thank you so much for letting us know. We'll definitely distribute that information. Well, thank you so much, Avi, for sharing your thoughts and insight into, you know, Jewish camping, and a lot of great nuggets for any Jewish professional to be able to walk away with. So I really appreciate your time.
Thinking about my conversation with Avi, there are few roles in the Jewish community that are as tough as a full-time camp professional. Throughout the year, you are traveling and recruiting campers and summer staff while planning weeks of programming and experience for the summer. Then you're away from your home community and family for 8 to 10 weeks, making experiences for others. There's no doubt the impact of Jewish camping on those who grow up at summer camp. At any age, the experience of community at camp can be life-changing, a bubble where you belong, regardless of your experience elsewhere. The Foundation for Jewish Camp is doing a great job identifying the areas of support that Jewish professionals in this field need. A network of other professionals who they can commiserate with, congratulate, and learn from each other to keep them motivated and their attention on why they love their job. In thinking of your own role, what's the part that you feel like nobody gets and nobody understands? How can you seek out other professionals who have a similar experience to help provide some insight and continue to keep you motivated, thinking about why you love the work you do? I want to thank our podcast partner, the Jewish Theological Seminary. As I mentioned before, JTS offers a variety of professional graduate programs, including the Davidson School of Jewish Education's new Disabilities Inclusion Concentration, which is part of their MA in Jewish Education degree. To learn more, you can visit www.jtsa.edu/admissions. Our editor is Nick Bowden of Bowden Sound. You can find previous episodes, guest bios, book recommendations, and more on our website. It's whoyouknowthepodcast.com. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful week.
Like this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.